Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him. I'm a queer political activist, actor, comedian, self-proclaimed sexy blurred. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by other fabulous minorities and some allies tackling the news, pop culture, politics, media, entertainment, and history with a little self-care, self-love sprinkled throughout, all for our own personal and collective empowerment.
Well, we are going back to high school, literally, because y'all, my old prom date from high school is here on the show. Yes, Leah E. is here. She, her. Leah is a digital marketer, hot sauce enthusiast, traveler, obscure fact seeker, and comedy admirer. And we go all the way back. Now, what is this? A few decades. Yes, we were Bonnie and Clyde looking fly in our zoot suits. And well, I was in a zoot suit. She was not. She was looking all flapper-like. It was dope. And also, Leah is part of the reason why Minority Corner even exists, is she helped coin the title of the show all the way back in high school. So you're going to hear the origins of Minority Corner. It goes further back than just me and Aneke at a pool thinking, hey, we should do a show. So Leah is OG Minority Corner back when it was still spelled with a C. And we talk the HBO documentary The Vow and our personal connection to this cult. I don't know if you're watching this HBO documentary, but man, it had a shook at one point as it helped me realize my near miss with this cult and just the myriad of issues and things this show is bringing up. And we start piecing together its connections to other live and well cults like QAnon and Agent Orange and his following. It's all cults, y'all. And then in the main corners, it is the Minority Corner Book Club. As promised from last week, we do a deep dive into Angela Davis's book, Are Prisons Obsolete? The book asks the questions, we dive in, and we have our answer, and you'll see what it is by the episode's end. It is a deep one. You will be primed and ready to take action by the end of this episode. And we've decolonized our bookshelves before, and Leah is going to help us decolonize our food because, yes, we are coming for your fridges, y'all. Because even your food has footprints of colonization. And we ask appreciation versus appropriation when it comes to certain people opening restaurants. Really interesting question and conversation that we get into, because nothing is safe, y'all. We've been fed lies, literally. Well, let's feed ourselves with some knowledge and some giggles and some fun. It's going to be a good one. Leah is here. Let's learn, laugh, and play right here on Minority Corner. Let's go. Leah sucks. That's how we're starting. That's how we're starting this show. Leah sucks. Runs and hides behind trash cans.
I like close the Zoom.
Everybody, one of my oldest friends, not old because you're old because we're just have known each other for like over three decades. Yes, Leah, my dear friend from high school, is here on the show. So glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's cool to see what you're doing.
And that was an old school callback because one time back in junior high school, we won't name who she was, but for whatever reason, somebody who was, dare I say, jealous of Leah just yelled, Leah sucks. And then we watched her run behind some dumpsters. Like it was a secret. Like it was going to be like, ooh, who said that? We're like, oh.
No one else is around. It's not even like mistaken identity. Like, who could have been?
It was her. It was her. It was Christy Kirkland. Oh, well, it's been said. Oh, she's a big fan of the show. Oh, my gosh.
I was just about to say a Costco brand of...
Oh, yeah. Costco. You know what's so great having you on the show is that you are actually part of where the Minority Corner namesake comes from. Like, you helped to name Minority Corner. You're one of the, like, OGs of Minority Corner.
One of the founding members. Like, I wish we should do a reunion with all... It was four of us? Five of us?
There was four of us. Yeah. So like we dubbed ourselves Minority Corner because we were all in the AP honor classes together. And it was like a handful of us minorities. And we always were sat in the corner. Not that we chose to, but for whatever reason, we were always put in the corner.
We put ourselves by choice in the corner. Active defiance.
It's minorities in the corner. And that's Minority Corner. There it is. That's what was born. And then, man, it was so interesting being in like Solano County. It was very diverse, but like our exploration and understanding of like navigating race, because it was, you know, the 90s, everything seemed sort of post-racial, even though like we knew racist shit was kind of like happening, you know, like there was a clique that we did dub the Nazis and maybe as a joke, but looking back, they were tiki torturers. We did an infamous video project. We could do an extra credit video project. It was around like the Civil War. And we did like a mockumentary news report of like very inappropriate of all kinds of things. It was like there was a slave. Was there a slave race? And someone, I just remember someone like jumping out of behind a tree. Like someone, so, oh yeah, someone, she was black, going, "Ooh, child, I'm lost. Which way to the Underground Railroad?" It was Adrian. She was like, "Oh, Adrian." She was like, "Ooh, child, God. I'm lost. Which way to the Underground Railroad?" And then, and then white girl Jessica jumps out and she's like, "This way." And she's literally like, she's a slave owner. We got all the theater kids and all their prop guns to reenact the Civil War. You were a news reporter reporting live. And then like the slave catcher tries to catch you because they're like, "What race are you?" And you're like, "Gotta go."
Who was Mike? Wasn't he the... Oh,
rest in power. Mm. Michael Flores. Legit. But yeah, we were just making, and we thought it was funny, but the rest of our probably white classmates were probably uncomfortable.
They were very, yeah. I feel like, it was ahead of its time.
It was.
That's higher.
And, it was really the first bit of content for Minority Corner.
We're
full
circle.
It's a podcast. You know, speaking of the whole entire Trump administration, it's very much, or the following, you were like, "Oh, but his followers." And I think what it's made me realize is it's a cult. It is very much a cult-like experience. And I'm obsessed with cults. Like I was obsessed with Scientology. Like not like me doing.
Like how obsessed? Like you went to a session there? Like
no, like I'm obsessed with the session? People who do it. Like, so I've seen like every episode of Leah Remini's like Scientology show.
Man.
And like she's literally
she's
like
so brave.
She is, because they're like trying to ruin folks' lives, and she is literally like leading the FBI. She's doing the FBI's work. She's like leading the breadcrumbs with her fucking TV show. Like FBI, just watch Leah Remini's The Aftermath, and you'll figure out all the shenanigans and have a case to like bring down Scientology. But another one that has been on is HBO's The Vow, which that. 9 episodes I just finished. It is a lot. I remember hearing about Nixium when it was first blowing up, and it was around hashtag Me Too. It was starting to come alive that there was this sex cult and they were being branded. And Allison Mack, who I grew up watching on Smallville. Mm-hmm. was all up in it. I was like, "What? Oh my gosh." It's heartbreaking. And all these actors from Battlestar Galactica that I also loved, like, are all up in it too. Like,
it like hits you twice. Like, not just once.
Oh, and then the hits keep coming. Because as I'm watching the show, I had to text Leah because I had a moment. I'm watching this show, and I notice a familiar looking face. Like they're showing like photos of people who've been involved. And there's like the main people who are like leaving the cult. And it's very interestingly shot because it's the guy who did What the Bleep, which I remember watching that movie.
I know. I do too. That was so weird he was like associated with that.
But that's the thing is that like the thing that makes you realize it's like it's not like no one sets out to join a cult. It's usually like at the base level of any cult like organization, it usually is fulfilling sort of potholes in people's minds or psyches or spirit that are missing. It's sort of like filling in the blanks of like making meaning out of life when it doesn't make sense, and gives people a sense of purpose. And usually at the base level of most cults, like the base level stuff is actually really good, where it's like, you know, get rid of your fears and, you know, being your best self and showing up for humanity. And it's like, oh yeah, yeah, I want some of that. That sounds good. It's just like when you go further up
when the sashes start coming, you're like, you can now become a level 5.
Well, and that's the thing with these things, because they teach you to, like, you know, go against your fears, right? They're like, oh, fear's coming. So if you're having like fearful thoughts about like, oh, this sash seems really weird, it's like, that's your limiting belief.
And I know, you're like, they use it against you. It's the Jedi mind trick.
Oh my gosh. And you're like, well, I'm just trying to be the best person that I can be to show up in the world. And they use all, like, spend all this time like crafting this, like, these ideas for you. And like you said, they use it against you. Anyways, I'm watching like episode 4 and I'm like, oof, I'm deep into this. I'm getting like my roommates to watch it. I'm watching episode 4 and around these people who are escaping, who are like doing the documentary, and they're surrounded by someone. I'm like, that person looks familiar. That looks like a friend of mine from high school. I take a photo. I send it to Leah, and I'm like, Leah, is this? We'll call her Felicia. I'm like, Leah, holy shit, is this Felicia?
And literally in parallel, I had done the same thing like the week before and started doing some recon. I was like, ooh, like, is it Felicia? And like, I start like digging in the crate. I'm like, where am I gonna, you know, find that? And it turns out it is indeed Felicia.
It confirmed, to the point where somebody else, some other person from high school, was like, hey, I saw this trailer for this Val documentary, and tagged Felicia, like, Felicia, is this you? Calling her out. And dang. And so I'm like, I was talking to Leah. Leah's like, oh, maybe you should get her on the show. And I was like, well, I don't know if I want to, like, you know, exploit her or anything like that. But like, I am someone who is, I think why I watch these cult documentaries is because, like, I know I'm susceptible to cults. I love personal empowerment, let's change the world, work on ourselves. Like, that is, this is like, I've had near misses with cults where I was like, ooh.
What?
Oh, yeah. There's a
wait, which
long cult? Story. It was called Access Consciousness.
Oh, boy.
And it turns out it was a spinoff from Scientology. But I was listening to these podcasts, and
that's how they get you, the gateway.
It was, yeah, I was down a rabbit hole. That's a whole other story. And so I've had these near misses with cults, right? And so that's why I like to watch these documentaries. I'm like, how did it happen? I don't want this to happen to me. And then I was like, when's the last time I messaged Felicia? And I look back in my Facebook message chat thread, and I am shook, because the last time Felicia was messaging me was just a few years ago, and she was like, hey, I'm part of this personal empowerment program we're doing, in Vancouver and Los Angeles, would love for you to come and take some classes. And luckily I'm Mr. Busy Guy, and I had ignored it, and then I just hadn't seen it. And then she was like, hey, I saw your flash mob. And that was like, I was like, let's chat, you saw my flash mob. And then we're chatting, and then she was like, hey, we're coming up to San Francisco. We never do workshops in San Francisco. This is like a once-in-a-life opportunity in personal empowerment and self-development and growth. I think you'd be really great at it. And luckily, I was like, oh, I'm really busy that weekend, but I would love to. Like, let me know when it's coming around again. Thank God. Thank goddess I was too busy, because Felicia was a good friend of mine in high school, and I would have gone. I love personal empowerment and self-development. I would have been wearing these sashes. I would have been, you know, doing all these things. And
was it the Society of Protectors? I could see, I would have you
been
just totally.
Oh,
like,
I would have so been in the Society of Protectors. Oh my God. And I
would have been on that in the like welcome video.
I would have been in one of the welcome videos. I had to stop watching the show for a while because I was so shook about how close I was involved. Like, I was like a stone's throw away. Again, near misses, another near miss from a fucking cult. So save
the minute, if they had tried to get me and I went to one of those sessions, and the minute I saw people kissing each other on the mouth, I'd be like, I'm out. I'm like, this is part of the cult. I'm good. Personal space.
I went
space.
To Santa Cruz. I went to hippie school. I don't. I'm an actor and an artist. And like, and I think what really frustrates me is like, I think the thing that like so many actors end up winding up in these cults because they're like, first of all, being in the industry is a very emotionally jarring experience. It's very lonely. It's very isolating. It is about you have to overcome your fears and be fearless. And you're just trying to be the best version of yourself in an industry that's trying to destroy you. And you're looking for community because a lot of times it can feel so lonely and isolating. And so you find these community spaces. Like I'm even having like some flashbacks to an acting training program that I was in. And there was some like cult like it feelings to it where there's like hierarchies and your leaders sort of destroying you to rebuild you in their image sort of a thing. And and also to the thing with the NXIVM documentary The Vow, I know some people are like, oh man, this could have been like 3 or 4 episodes. I will admit it does sort of like lag once you see like once you go it's really brilliantly done because the first episode they teach you just about like all the base level things about the organization. You're like, oh, this sounds really great. Yeah. And then as it goes on, you're learning the other levels and layers to it. And then by the end of it, like you see, like you're like, how did this organization end up happening? You see about how all the men were also complicit into, you just see the like the deep rooted misogyny that was there that, and these women think like, oh, they're just trying to make me a better person. But you see Keith Rainier, which thank God he's in prison and just got sentenced.
He's locked up.
Throw away the key. For 120 years was his sentence?
Yeah, I was like, whoa, that was just excessive. But they wanted the point to be known that he's not coming anywhere. He's going to start a cult in prison. Everyone realizes that, right?
Well, like, we will get to prisons in a moment later on in this episode. But yeah, it just like you just realize just like how like he it's interesting because he was hiding in plain sight with he was really like laying out the blueprints of his sociopathic nature and his hatred towards like women right there. But you couldn't see it because you can't see the forest for the trees when you're right in the middle of it.
Right. And I think you make such a good point like about him kind of targeting people who maybe were susceptible to needing a sense of community. And that's kind of that classic cult handbook. That's what they do. They look for people who are marks.
Yeah. But the thing is that like and it could honestly it could if you get hit at like the right opportunity, like when if you're feeling low, it could happen to anybody, even like the strongest of people if you don't have, you know, and no one thinks they're joining a cult, you know. In my job, they were like, we're gonna build a cult brand. I'm like, absolutely. I can't. I'm not trying to build I'll build a community, but that's like a very, I think we need to like stop using that word of like, oh, it's like that movie, it's like a cult hit. Don't use that. It's so triggering.
It's triggering for people, yes. Like especially if you have family members or friends who've gone through it yourself.
And it's serious shit. You mean like, oh, that movie has a strong community, or there's a lot of people who really are passionate about it. Like, cults are a whole other thing. I don't want to create a cult brand. I'll create a community brand. Like Minority Corner, we're not a cult. There's no sashes. There's no hierarchy. I am not a vanguard.
You put yourself in the corner by choice.
You're here by choice. And you ain't getting nothing else except just giggles and information. So there's no bridge. There's no Xanadu. I forget what it's called in Scientology, but like Xanax. There's none.
I won't go on records speaking about the
sense. Come after me.
The other Leah taught me.
Oh, to not go after.
If I've learned anything from the other Leah, Rimini.
Oh my God. It's because they have tax exemption status. And like, for a long time, like, that's the thing is that, like, how, if you have money, how you can get away with things for so long, because the Seagram's heiress was able to like help NXIVM destroy the lives of anybody who would come after them.
That's like part of the playbook too. You need an heiress.
It's money and it's power.
Poor India too. I feel like 3 episodes were done. Yeah. I felt so horrible for her mom. Like,
yes. Meanwhile, Felicia was in a photo with all these people like hugging up all
kinds of too, not even to the side.
I was shook.
Straight in the front.
Shook. And apparently Keith Raniere in his sentencing like really had like the reason why he got 120 years because the judge was like, I feel like you have like no remorse. Like he's, you know.
Oh, that's what he. Mm.
He's like, but he didn't. He was like, for Allison Mack, he's like, oh, but you know, don't. You know, don't lump her into what I did or whatnot. But I'm sorry. Especially it was like, I'm sorry if people got hurt. Like, it was like a non-apology.
I really want to hear the Allison Mack side.
Well, season two, I think that's what we're...
Ooh, she's going to come out of the... Oof.
I don't know. But that's my whole entire thing is that, like, so now I have an understanding. Like, when you're like, how are all these people so blind, loyal to Trump?
I know you invoked Voldemort.
To Agent Orange, Donna Trump. I just always hear Donna when I hear people say Donald, but I always hear Donna. And I think of Donna Martin in 90210. Donna Martin graduates. And he would lose his shit if he heard that people were calling him Donna. The joke's on him. It's a cult. Like, it really is where it's like a cult happens if people can't, if you're not able to objectively or critically think. And when you're presented with information, you just blindly can't see anything else. Like, there's people who are coming out of QAnon is a cult where they're just fed information. And it filled. There's this one guy who came out of QAnon and he was like, it filled. First of all, he was in a low point when he was falling into it. And you read these articles and these YouTube videos and it just pieces together because there's the things like you're like, why is this thing happening? Or I don't really understand this in the world. And someone like pieces certain things together and you're like, that makes sense. That's okay. That, oh yes. They bathe in the blood of children underneath a pizza shop. Yes. That makes sense.
And so it's like keyword research. They're like, ooh, as they're like basically hitting us with different pieces of content abroad. They're like, what are people resonating with? Baby.
Yeah, they're
blood,
literally just throwing
bathing.
Spaghetti. And you know what? I get it. People love children and they hate demons and they want to stop that. And so if they hear that, like, oh, demons and blood are happening, they're like, well, let me put an end to this. But check your sources. Know it for yourself. Do some research.
Has it happened to you in passing where you're maybe just speaking to someone and all of a sudden they kind of just casually bring up like a QAnon theory? And
no.
And then it's like an uncomfortable situation because let's say it's someone you don't know very well and you're like, like this recently happened to me because we were talking about the Epstein Island. And this person was like, oh, yes. Well, do you know Biden has a secret island you can only get to by submarine? God. And I was like,
get out I of wish, my face.
I wish I was
go
making
away.
It up.
By
real life.
Submarine?
This is real life. And then I was like, oh. God. And
then do people even understand? Like, people like are seen too many Austin Powers or movies. Submarines, like, how many people it takes for one to like operate a fucking like submarine? And like, do people not remember that Joe Biden, like, the train is expensive, but like, he ain't got no submarine kind of money. Like,
he does not.
The man was like, I think, rated like the poorest senator in the Senate. Like, and so, like, you know, again, like, he's not living, you know, in, you know, a cardboard box, but like, he ain't got no submarine, let me tell you. I just casually said it. And so that's the thing. This is like why, like, we got to check our sources.
And there's Snopes. Like, I'm like, come on, people. Like, if you hear a piece of hearsay, plug it in to Snopes. Just like, you know, do a little due diligence.
Do, as my grandmother used to say, know it for yourself.
There you go. That's truly the gospel. Because it's like, how? And she was serious. She was like, no, did you hear about it? And I was like, Like, I'm like inching away. I'm like,
oh. That's how. And see, that's how it starts. And then she clicked on that and it's just going to start feeding more and more information. It's also why I highly recommend, if you haven't seen it, the documentary, the Social Dilemma on Netflix.
Oh, it was great.
So great, right? Like,
really good.
It's worse than we thought it was. Like, social media, we were like, we all know, like, after 2016, we're like, oh, it's bad, right? And in that documentary, just put it in perspective of like, oh, it's worse than we thought it was.
I was so grateful when you and I were in high school, there wasn't social media like there is today. That would have been freaking horrible.
I don't think that I don't know how kids do it. I remember when I was being bullied by the NRA as an adult on Twitter, that was hard enough. I couldn't imagine if it was like, you know, Felicia or Joey Dean from high school from the football team or something, you know?
Instead of Leah Sucks Behind the Dumpster, it would have been like
yes.
All over.
Christy Kirkland would have had more than just the power of her voice dances. And a dumpster. And you see, that is a good example because it shows how people like want to just say shit and hide, and how social mm-hmm. media just like exacerbates that, because she couldn't even say, she was pent up inside of her. She couldn't even just say, Leah sucks to your face. She had to go hide behind a dumpster.
And such a like, yeah.
And now we hide and mind this podcast, Christy Kirkland.
I'm just, yeah, it would just been exacerbated. Can you imagine?
Oh, God, even worse. And that's the thing. I was also reading this book called 10 Reasons to Delete Your Social Media Account Now. And it's just like the crux of it is like, it's just not safe right now. Like, we need government like regulation. We need some people to come in to like make it safe. The Google and Facebook or whatnot need to pay for our data. Like, there's just all kinds of things that need to happen. Maybe there's a paid structure where it's like, you know, I would be happy if there was a thing of like Facebook, I'd pay $5 a month for a subscription to make sure that like everybody's a real person. And I'd be happy to sponsor, because I would like everybody to participate. Maybe there's someone who you can sponsor people's partner. Like, you know, we need to rethink how we're using it, because if advertisers are driving it, then we're the commodity, and then we're just being used and manipulated. And it's just like, it's not safe. Make the Christy Kirklands of the world
show their face.
Oh my God.
They can't hide behind the dumpster.
Yes. You show your face.
Which is a metaphor for the internet.
Twitter. Yes. You can't hide behind the dumpster that is the internet. Okay. You need to be doing it in plain sight. Last thing. Anybody who's like, my vote doesn't count, watch the fucking documentary 537 and you will see, holy shit, the 2000 election was decided by 537 votes in Miami-Dade, and it's such an interesting documentary. It's so well done. It's on HBO. And this is like when you and I were in high school together, 2000s, things were
different time.
I definitely had a friend of mine who was like rubbing it in my face that Bush had won, and she has since.
What? Who is that? And you're like, I'm like, cut the mic.
We'll call her Janice. Janice Q.
Oh, really? Actually, no, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, but now is like reformed, or you know, seen the light. It's hard. We went to school on a military base, so there are some conservative ideas and values, even though the current conservatives don't give a flying fuck about the military or American ideas or values or patriotism or anyway. But it's interesting. The first 30 minutes of the documentary are actually about Ilian Gonzalez, and I did not realize how much that set the stage of, just for an example, that like most of the Cubans in Cuban Americans down in Florida, like they were so bent on like Ilian is going to stay here in this country. And so when Janet Reno, underneath the Clinton administration, which Gore is attached to, when she sent him back, and they did go get that boy with like the photos are really bad. There's like a gun in his face. That poor traumatized kid. Like,
yeah, where, man. Did they talk about where he is now? Like, what he's doing now?
I want to know. Can someone, maybe he's listening, Ilian, let us know. You can come on the show. We'd love to hear from you. But I'm wondering, like, because he, trauma, survived, the only person to survive, like, in that little raft, right? The little inner tube.
Oh, that was
the
inner tube.
And then it's just, like, a political puppet, right? Of, like, and all of a sudden, like, then, because Republicans saw that it was popular amongst Cubans, Republicans don't give a fuck. They don't like anybody who's not like white, British, maybe German coming over in this country. Like, if there was a little boy from China coming over, they would have been like, oh, just send him right on back. Like, they don't give a fuck. But they were trying to pretend like they cared of like about, you know, immigration. Like, look at them now. They're like building up fucking walls. Like, where, like, and so anyways, like, as an example, Clinton had won, I think, like 35% of the Cuban vote. And it was estimated you needed at least 30% for a Democrat to win Florida. And then Gore only won about 25%. And it was looked at that this was a retaliation vote of what happened to Ilian Gonzalez. And there were other things, like the Democratic mayor at the time of Miami-Dade was doing some political foolishness, even though he was a Democrat. Was like, you just see how people are just... Sometimes the system can be just so hungry for power. And like, the Democrats weren't willing to play dirty, that like the Republicans were showing up. They stormed during they're counting the votes. These white guys in khakis pretending to be Cubans were like storming where they were counting the votes, saying like the whole world is watching, and they were hired Republican operatives. And there's just all these like crazy things that happen. And it's like, and you think about like all the things that happened. This isn't me being a conspiracy theorist, but like
James
Gore used to read James and Jay Anon. This is what I heard from Felicia Anon, F Anon. Oh God. But if you think about it, it's just certain things that like the environment would be in a different shape. I mean, Al Gore in the environment. Hello. I saw him do the Inconvenient Truth presentation live. Like, we'd have a different relationship.
The polar ice caps are melting.
We'd have a different relationship with the environment. He is a person who reads the intelligence, and I don't think
invented the internet.
He invented the internet too. So we would have regulation. We wouldn't be having these garbage fires on Twitter. You know, Chrissy Kirkland would have to be saying it to the face once again. Not behind the dumpster internet. And then, yeah, like, and so also too, I don't think that 9/11 would have happened. And if it would have, we wouldn't have ended up in Iraq. Because again, how did we end up there?
Like Saddam.
There it is. There it is. Coming in full circle. Mm-hmm. Here it is. We were, you know, 20 years ago, we were in high school. That time, we thought that was the most important election. And you just look at, like, it was an election that we're still feeling the effects of it. And here it is, 20 years later, like, the most important election of a lifetime. So, go vote, y'all. 537 votes changed the world.
That's great. And then I saw the trailer, and I forget what the acronym CHAD stands for. He's like, there was pregnant Chads, there was falling off Chads, there was Chads on the floor. It's like those particles, right? In the punch votes, that's what Chads are.
Yes.
What's the acronym, yeah. Do you know?
Candace has a diaper. I don't know.
<That's right.
laughs> Oh, God. She's there's like 10,000 votes that were never even counted, and the way the punch cards were, because also voter, like, in Miami-Dade, they don't have as much money, so they had these old antiquated systems. And so it becomes a thing of just sort of like economics, voter disenfranchisement, how many people in Florida couldn't vote because they were, you know, felt like returning citizens that they had been, you know, had prison time. Yeah. So speaking of prisons, let's have a conversation about prisons and whether or not they're obsolete. We're going to do a little Minority Corner book review of Angela Davis's book, Are Prisons Obsolete?
Hi. Are you someone who thinks that when one door closes, another one opens?
Someone who always sees the light at the end of the tunnel?
If you answered yes to one or both of these questions, good for you.
We are not those people.
Nope. I'm Annabelle Gurwitch, and I'm a, you know, that other door opening? It probably leads to a broom closet kind of person.
And I'm Laura House. When I see a light at the end of a tunnel, I assume it's a train headed right toward me.
Laura and I have created a brand new podcast for people like us. It's called Tiny Victories. We're sharing personal tiny victories or things we've read or seen that inspire resilience.
So if you're looking for a tiny reason to get out of bed each week, subscribe to Tiny Victories.
Available on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get tiny.
Okay. Let's talk about prisons. So I took a class with Angela Davis back in 2008, which I just found out in an article was her last class. I got the last Angela Davis class.
Wow, you got lucky.
She retired. My mom was like, you have to take a class with Angela Davis. And I'm like, who's she? Because we're not going to learn that in our history class about Angela Davis. Like at Vanden High School, we were not going to learn about it. So since George Floyd's death, I've been wanting to revisit this because there has been a lot of talk and conversations. A lot of people welcome. A lot of you folks are now understanding how fucked up the whole entire criminal justice system is. Welcome to the party. I've been talking about prison abolition for a long time because I took this class about the prison industrial complex with Angela Davis. Her ideas, like, she's been talking about these things for so long, and now people are catching up to them. And I think let's not stop with just ideas of defunding the police. And Angela Davis has a book called Are Prisons Obsolete? And it's just a question. And in 115 pages, she will answer that question. It is a cute little book. Just for example, why would we even look into this? Back in the 1960s, there were 200,000 people incarcerated. To this day, now there's 2.2 million. We make up 5% of the world's population, but 20% of the prison population. Also is a thing, I think that's how many, like, we make up 5% of the world's population, but 20% of, like, the coronavirus, like, cases. Okay, so let's look into this. So I'm going to take, there's just six chapters, and I just want to highlight some of, like, the points that I found were interesting from these chapters. So the first one is, some people are like, you know, prison abolition or prison reform. Why don't we just reform the prisons? Valid question. I could see how you would think that. You're like, but we had to have prisons. Why would we abolish them? So let's look at that. So larger prison populations have not led to safer communities. We can't say all those people in prisons. It's not like everything is necessarily meant that that crime is just, like, you know, gone away. So that alone is like, oh, the system is, you know, not necessarily, doesn't mean that it's working. 2/3 of prisons that we have were built in the 80s underneath Reagan. So people take prisons for granted, kind of like, you know, the sky is blue. It's just like this thing that has always been around there. And we shouldn't just because something has always existed doesn't mean that we shouldn't question it or think, is there a better way? And by having a prison, it relieves the responsibility of really engaging with what the problem is. It puts it, oh, the prisons will take care of it. As opposed to, like, anybody who's having to go to prison is really, oh, we fucked up. We failed as a society, right? Like, we failed. Keith Rainier, I don't know, this is a weird example, but man, we failed him as a society, although he kind of failed himself. I don't know. Weird example, but, like, we can't.
He's a bit of an outlier.
He's an outlier. And maybe there is a system or something for, like, a Keith Rainier, but doesn't mean, like, everybody should be looped into the same system for some of these issues.
And also, he had a lot of privilege.
Yes.
Backing
100%.
That a lot of people do not. You know what I mean? Like, if it was someone else.
Right.
Who had a different skin color than Keith. He may have been incarcerated, like, from the first person he recruited.
And we had talked about this last week, is that Harvard did a study and they came up with the one reason why there are so many Black people are so overrepresented in the prison population. And the answer is, do you want to know what the answer is?
What's the answer?
Racism. Boo, they took a big study. All this money. Good job, Harvard. Ding, ding, ding. Racism. Like,
hot up the press.
And so the other thing to look at this, too, because we're looking at this critically, right? We're having a conversation of, like, okay, are prisons obsolete? We're posing this question. And we look at it, though, mass imprisonment, it generates profits. So that should sit really weird in everyone's stomach, that it's a money-making machine. That's weird. Like, my nonprofit theater company is a nonprofit theater company that I was working at. And the job is, like, they're just trying to tell art and pay the people and break even, right? So, like, you know, and there are some arts that are trying to, you know, create, you know, profits or whatnot. But, like, prisons as a profit and engineering machine, that they're even, like, you know, for some communities, they're like, yeah, we're going to get a, like, it's even been sort of advertised. We'll get a prison in here and it's going to help the redevelopment and jumpstart the local economy. That's disgusting because we're talking about human beings being the commodity. And so these prisons, they devour social wealth and they actually tend to reproduce the very conditions that they're trying to, quote unquote, like, fight against or rehabilitate against.
Well, then also it's, you know, all these companies that are also benefiting from prison labor is really problematic.
100%.
So I feel like, I mean, I know a few off, I don't want to misquote the companies, but I think, like, Victoria's Secret's one of them.
Yep.
I'm sure you can find a whole list, obviously, online.
Oh, the list is astronomical. And I think that's something that, like, that's a great point that you brought up, because we all are actually benefiting from the prison industrial complex, which has roots in slavery, which we're going to get to in a moment. And so, you know, we kind of need to, like, are you comfortable with that? Like, are you comfortable benefiting off of, you know, the detriment of other, not only human beings, but, hey, American citizens, you know, who everyone has done something illegal before. We all have. So I just want to put that there. Everybody has done something illegal. You know it. We all have done it. It has happened. Jaywalking, that's a crime. And for some people, they've ended up in prison because of it, right? Because it's in the color of their skin. So you're looking at the system. It's flawed. Media also has actually had a great impact in reinforcing these institutions, like but the way that it's presented in media for, you know, generations, as it's been glamorized as this one thing that it really isn't. It hasn't really been telling the true stories of what goes on behind those walls and those and the experiences. It's just been kind of like fabricated, like a Dickens novel about like, oh, Christmas, like it was just created, or the story of Christopher Columbus, like it just like was fabricated in these novels that we have just been taking as fact, and they're not. And so we have this over reliance on this system, and the thing that I would say from this of like why abolition versus reform, can you reform a system that is already broken, racist, sexist, violent, class, that is, you know, based on a caste system, a class system, it's homophobic, it's rooted in slavery? That would be my question. And I think that's why this book is investigating abolition and not reform. Okay, so that's the premise of it. Oof, okay, let me move through these. So chapter two.
I mean, on that point, though, I do feel like you're saying, to go in with such a broken system and try to fix it, is it better just to start from scratch and rebuild?
Yes. And we have to kind of not be afraid to, like, if something is broken, like, if sometimes something is just broken, and it's like, just start over. Like, this, if I have a bunch of holes in my shoes, I don't tend to just like try to patch it up. I mean, after a while, I'm gonna let it go or just buy some new shoes, right? Like, and then. So the second chapter talks about how, like I mentioned earlier, the prison system has roots in slavery. And essentially, like, if you look at this, think about things that we don't do anymore because we're like, that's fucked up and against, you know, human beings' rights. Slavery, lynching, Jim Crow, black codes, segregation. They were all institutions that were literally considered as everlasting as the sun, right? It was just like, yep, we have these things. They were just part of the norm until people said, no, we're not going to do this anymore, and that's why. And I think we can look at prisons possibly as the same way. Back in the day, it was originally thought that prisons would be sort of like monasteries where people would be able to go and reflect on their crimes and rehabilitate. So that was kind of the initial reasons. And actually, back in the day, you went to prison before the actual punishment happened. So back in the day, it was like, you're going to go wait over here, and then you're going to get, like, drawn or quartered or, like, you know, like all these other severe punishments. And they were like, ooh, that's, no, we're not going to do that anymore. Why don't we just keep them in the prison place? Oh, yeah, we'll just do that. So it was a fix for the crime and punishment of the day that was, like inhumane, right? But it doesn't mean, I think, like, every generation has to take things a step further, and it doesn't mean that we need to, like, still stay at the system that was meant to fix an issue that was already happening. And so you essentially start to see, like, after slavery, you start to see a robustness of prisons in the U.S. They have a still sort of similar dynamic between subordinate and subject. You have the slave codes or the black codes, which would essentially criminalize and target black people on the presumption of race. And so you started seeing the numbers of black folks going up, where black people could literally, I mean, they just wrote a law and they're like, oh, you can't be standing on the sidewalk while black. I mean, it's essentially like things you see, like remnants of these black codes that still essentially exist today, how black people are specifically targeted. So we're, again, looking at the roots of these things, we want to keep those around. And then you had penal labor or servitude. Like you were saying that like there was convict leasing and chain gangs that were happening. So people literally would like free from slavery, get arrested, and then were sent to and hired through these convict leasing programs. And they were building like infrastructure and streets, farming, all kinds of stuff. So there's even like towns today, like I think downtown Atlanta, like Peachtree Street was built by like convicts, you know? So the world that we're around, and like these things are still, you know, occurring today. And the worst part about the convict leasing program is that slaves got better treatment than the prisoners, because at least with the slaves, it was a property. And they were going to try to take better care of you. But if you were just someone who's leased to me, I don't give a flying fuck what happens to you. So living conditions would be even worse. Treatment would be worse. And you start seeing the slave to prison pipeline. I remember reading this one point in the book where you were talking about there's things that we are existing with that were made by prisons and how we're all part of the system. I was reading in this book by Angela Davis, and it says that, like, oh, even some of the University of California furniture has been made in prisons. I'm sitting at my desk at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I'm like, I'm a part of the system reading this fucking book. So we see prisons, they're racist institutions, similar to slavery, lynching, and Jim Crow. Why would we keep those? Asking, you know, putting the question again. And they got rid of those things that seemed like that's just the law of the land. The things like that have been abolished before. Then in chapter three, they talk about, you know, history of reform. I had mentioned how prisons were a reform against crime and punishment of, like, okay, we're going to stop, like, you know, drawing and quartering people, which is, like, where they would put people, like, in the stock and barrel things, or, like, stretching people's, like, limbs. And in 1764, Cesar Beccari wrote an essay saying that punishment should never be a private matter nor arbitrarily violent. It should be swift, public, and as lenient as possible. I think it's a very interesting concept. Because there's an issue when you put it privately, right? Where it's like, it's similar, like when war happens, we don't have to think about it, right? Like the prisoners, oh, they're off away. We don't have to think about it. Da, 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 da. But if there was a different sort of a system that was like, not saying like people should be like flogged in the middle of the street or something, but that wouldn't be a punishment for some people.
Right.
But
you never know.
You never know. They're like, ooh, I'm a be bad, so I could get, you know, Folsom Street Fair. But there was this concept of the panopticon that was crafted a few centuries ago, where it was this idea that prisoners should be monitored and watched and controlled. And you can't see who's watching you, but you know that there's always this presence. And that has evolved even in today. There's security cameras all over the place, because the idea was, like, if you're always like you're being watched, then you're going to be, like, you know, acting on behavior. And you have these supermax prisons where folks are locked up for 23 hours a day. They have no recreational, like, activity or connection with other people. And that in itself, it's so inhumane, because human beings, we need connection. Like, social media is seeing what's happening when we don't have true, genuine connection. You get cults and QAnons and Trump, you know?
Misinformation,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so there was a time when it was like there was a people would be able to write in prison and grow, and you were rewarded. Like back when Malcolm X was in prison, he was rewarded for his interest in reading and education, so that he got to check out more books. He'd have to try to like read at crazy times, because like they were like, oh, you can't be reading right now. So he had to work against the system to be able to get his education. But you get really great writings out of, you know, there was a time when you used to get really great prisoner writings, as they were able to reflect. And you had Malcolm X, his novel, Assata Shakur, all these really great writings. And Malcolm X said, months passed without me even thinking about being in prison. I had never been so free in my life, as he read and read and read. And so there used to be like graduation programs where you could get like a degree, and there used to be all this like funding. All of that is pretty much like gone. There's a documentary called The Last Graduation, and it's about the last graduation that was in like one of these prisons. And it's just because Pell Grants were taken away after the 1994 crime bill. Yeah, after the 1994 crime bill, it started gutting a lot of these things that we had. So it was like, even so, if you're trying to look at this idea that like, oh, it's a place for people to go and rehabilitate, but if you've taken away all of those programs, like if the system was working, then I'm like, oh, everybody in prison should be like, you know, learning computer programming or something, you know, like there should be something so you can come out and be ready to be be a reentered citizen of the United States. But we've taken away that. So really, again, these systems are just
horrible,
fostering and creating the system that they're supposedly trying to, like, you know, fight to change or to not, you know, be for. And you have people who maybe weren't even into violent crime, and they're around other people who maybe were, and it just sort of reaffirms that. It just creates more of it. So how effective is the system? And then Attica, 1971, the great prison riot. They were looking for, it was a government-sponsored massacre, essentially, that ended up happening. All they had concerns, they had practical demands about diet, improvement in quality guards, more realistic rehabilitation programs, and better education programs. Those could not, they were never met. And ended up in the government under Nelson Rockefeller, who's the governor, ordering the National Guard to go in. 43 Attica prisoners and 11 guards and civilians were killed. And they had just these, you know, demands. When we look at women in the prison system, how gender has been affecting it, the system is even the way its treatment for women has been an interesting journey. And in one facet of like when women were starting to be in prisons, it was this weird thing. Women didn't really have any rights anyways. And so usually with prisons, you're taking away rights, right? Well, I was like, well, you didn't really have any rights anyways. So it was these weird sort of like, what are they doing with women? But when we look at it, like things like the strip cavity searches, and it's essentially state sanctioned sexual assault, plain and simple. And the horror stories that women have had to endure, the Stop State Sexual Assault movement. In the 1950s, women's rehabilitation was about correcting womanly behaviors and getting them to act, you know, more ladylike. So they'd have to be taking classes in like cooking and cleaning and sewing and baking. For Black women and women of color, it was just to essentially teach them to how to be more skilled in domestic servants. So they would then be able to leave and they'd get jobs like being a maid or a cook or a washwoman for, you know, white people. There's not a lot of data around like women. And also think about this too. Women were incarcerated in other ways throughout mm-hmm. history, psychiatric institutions. You saw like women, they're like, oh, we don't know how to deal with her. Put her in a sanitarium.
Have you, did you follow the Humans of New York story about Tanqueray?
I did not.
A friend recommended it to me and I read it, but basically part of her story, you should check it out. I'm trying to remember, it was like a few weeks ago I read it, but I think her mom had actually put her in jail. Like, you know what I mean? I think back in the day, like, you know what I mean? There weren't as many regulations on that. So I forgot the exact piece of the story, like the reasoning why, but yeah, that was another thing that made women vulnerable, right?
Wow. They were like, she doesn't want to clean or cook. She must be crazy. Because who wouldn't? What?
Like, you're not domestic enough.
Yes, you're right. She must be crazy. Put her away. And you know what? Snaps to the Quakers, because they were really trying to like do a lot of abolition. They were abolitionists. They were like, slavery, get rid of it. They had an idea of what they thought prison should be, which was sort of like the sort of monk idea of like, you're going to go away and have quiet reflection and learn and do writing. And that wasn't happening. So they were, and they make damn good oatmeal. So you know what, Quakers? I don't know what happened to you, where you went, but...
They're still there, probably in New York, upstate New York.
You're right. You know what? They were like, they have like their own like Wakanda. It's like Quakanda. They were like, we're just going to stay up here, wear our cute little hats, and eat our oatmeal because y'all wow. too much. Quakanda forever. And then also just like, so again, like you have these institutions, there's high reports of sexual abuse in women's prisons. And it's terrible because like, it's hard to get your voice even heard, even outside of a prison about, you know, sexual abuse or assault. And you're living with your abuser who has this power dynamic over you. So you have this like misconduct that's, you know, widespread. And even women have even recently in Arizona, there's women chain gangs, convict leasing programs that are happening. And Black women, prison incarceration for Black women today exceeds that of white men of the 1980s. So Black women are like women in general, the rise of women in prison is just it's going up. And it's interesting because the abuse that ends up happening. We don't live up to the United Nations standard for minimum rules of the treatment of prisoners because of the sexual abuse that happens. So we're not even meeting up to the UN standards for the Crime Act of 1958. And also to think about this, most women who've committed murder have usually it's against an abusive partner. So again, like, why is it this one glove fits all? We've failed the women in general for it to even get to this point. It shouldn't have happened, right? And so essentially with these, you know, without the uniform, without the power of the state, the strip search would just be sexual assault. So we have state sanctioned sexual assault. So again, our prisons are looking at this track record, our prisons obsolete. And then the last point the prison industrial complex. We talked about this. This is a money-making machine. All these different companies that also, like, when they build these prisons, they're like, oh, we got to fill them up.
Right.
And so then they, you know, working with the local officers and laws, they get the beds filled up. And then they're like, oh, these prisons are overcrowded. Better build a new prison. And it's this cycle that ends up starting happening where we're having to fill up these beds. You know, in mandatory minimums, we need to get rid of that. Joe Biden has a plan for that, not the platinum plan. I'm sorry, Ice Cube. I don't think it has anything about that. But they're going to have some platinum jobs. Exactly. And so there's strong links between the military industrial complex and the prison industrial complex, where, you know, the military has all these weapons and they give it to the police officers for them to use, where they're arming themselves again against their own people. Majority of people of color are essentially just back to being sources of profit. It's slavery all over again. They're just commodities. And where the funding could be going to other things. And there's so many corporations that, like, you know, the phone companies that are there at the prisons, they're getting money. The electrical companies, like all the different sort of things for the commissaries and the amount of, there's just so much money that even if it's a not for profit, even if it's a public prison. So, you know, people are like, oh, let's just get rid of the private prisons. The private prisons have influenced the way the state prisons run, because the way that they have run, and like the state prisons are also making money for the local state. So, and the way that they've been running it so efficiently, like, it's just as criminal and just as bad. There's abuse that's happening. And if you look at it from 1990 to 1998, the homicide rates have dropped. But the homicide stories in major new networks had, like, increased fourfold. So there's this system, even within the media, that is just feeding the prisons to the point where, like, it's hard for us to even imagine a world without it. And that's how much the prison is an impact and an effect on our society. Again, these are racist, sexist, homophobic, capitalist institutions, and any movement really needs to be a movement against all of this. So, are prisons obsolete? I would say yes. And it's the thing that they're so intrinsic in our lives that it's hard for us to even imagine a world without it. And that's an issue, because it's not working. Like, the numbers are just increasing. The havoc that it's reaching on communities. We are, as a society, we're creative individuals. We can send, like, a fucking person to the moon, but we can't figure out a new system. Like, I can get a self-driving car, but we can't figure out a new system for how to deal with when there's issues within society, when there's people who have fallen short because of, again, when someone's having to go to prison, for the most part, we as a society in some way have failed that person. So what are we going to do about it?
I think I always think about is the fact that, you know, private sector versus public sector, like how slow things are to move in the public sector, right? Because there's so much bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. There's not usually a lot of, integration and technology. The minds, not saying, you know, there aren't minds who are like thinking of alternatives to this, but at the same time, it's like, I feel like if there were to be some kind of meeting of the minds or some kind of, you know, consortium where people are getting together to kind of really, you know, brainstorm these problems and think of ways to constructively fix them, knowing what we know about therapy, knowing what we know about education, knowing what we know about, you know, giving people hobbies and interests or even crafting and therapy. Like, there's all of these outlets to make it a positive thing, but unfortunately, because it's run like a business, it dehumanizes the people who are incarcerated. So they're just seen as kind of like a product. It goes back to the social network, a product. Like, we're all, you know, obviously not imprisoned, but in a different way, kind of beholden to, you know, social media in a different way, because we are also seen as products. So it kind of, you know, like I said, both ways dehumanizes the people who are there.
And I think that's exactly what it is. Like, our system is, because America is run like a business, everybody becomes like a commodity or a product, mm-hmm. right? And like you said, it's like getting back to like the human nature of it, that having other resources that maybe for some people, like, first of all, mental health facilities, let's get those going. Fuck you, Ronald Reagan. Like, worst president ever, not ever, because there's a lot of, well, we've got one that's definitely in the running for it, and
he's, Biden told us
there's a lot of terrible ones. But yeah, mental health facilities, drug rehabilitation centers, housing for the homeless, like, and it costs us more money to have homeless people than it would be if we just gave everybody a base level dormitory or house. And if you want something extra, then you'll have to go and like work for it. But if everybody had their needs met, because also by having these prisons, by having people who are suffering in your society, it weighs on you. Whether you think it does or it doesn't, it does. Because you have to, you are affected by it in some way. When you have to walk by the person because you're like, oh, I can't give that person a dollar. Or there's, it affects you in a way. It's like a cancer in our society by having people who are suffering when they don't have to. We could be, you know, decriminalizing drugs, teaching men to be men and not abuse, you know, women, legalizing sex work, decriminalizing being undocumented immigrants, protecting women so they don't have to murder their abusers to save their own lives, having living wages and jobs and programs. Like, everybody should have a job available. There's enough work. There's enough things that need to get done. Infrastructure, there's so much stuff. Having welfare programs to be able to help people who need help. Like, we should be having a decarceration process and looking to how we can use less of it, using restorative justice or reparative justice. This system that we have, it isn't working. It hasn't been working. I think defund the police is really cute and great too, but I think moving towards abolishing the prison system, because this system isn't working. It hasn't worked. It didn't work. This was supposed to be a stepping stone towards a new system. And moving away from this, you know, punishment economy. And last thing I just wanted to say is in the Amazon Prime show, What the Constitution Means to Me, highly recommend. So fucking good. And by the end of it, there's just sort of this conversation that ends up happening about the Constitution. And you see all the ways that it has done such great things and also its shortcomings and also how like our rights have been just being taken away. And the Constitution, like, it's old, and even that, like, maybe we should just write a whole entire new thing. And they propose that idea in the doc, not the documentary, but in the show. And my brain is like, can't compute. That is so weird. Mind you, Chile just this week has moved. They're abolishing their current constitution and writing a new constitution. And they're voting on it. None of the politicians who are currently elected are going to be involved in the process. They're going to vote for new citizens. And it's going to be half women, half. It's going to be super diverse to write a new constitution. And if it makes sense, like, I think every organization, every business has to. Why are we still using this old ass fucking document? Like, we should actually have to rewrite a new constitution like every like 10, 15 years or so. It should have to be a new thing. And so, just because something's always been around, we should not take it for granted. I think if you were to ask yourself, what would you have done during slavery? Would you have been an abolitionist, or would you have fought against Jim Crow? Well, we are being challenged with our generation's version of that, and it's the prison system. And what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like you made a good point with, you know, defund the police. I think that, you know, as you were talking through this, I was thinking like holistically, we have to look at that piece of it too and basically overhaul how police are being trained and looking systemically where this is coming and why people are getting incarcerated in the first place, right? And changing that part of the system, because again, as you kind of outlined, people are profiting from this. So they're almost incentivized to incarcerate people, right? And that whole part of it is completely broken as well.
And so that's why we're not saying let's reform the prisons. It's so broken that we need something new. And it's an opportunity for us as inventive human beings to create something new. What could this look like? It's an opportunity, and we owe it to ourselves and our society to do it, because this shit is broken.
One quick thing I wanted to say too, someone told me recently, kind of talking about the homelessness problem, especially I feel like in the Bay Area right now, it's like we're faced with it every day, right? Buckminster Fuller is a name that was told recently to me, like, I guess in the 60s, I believe he was kind of prophesizing that people were going to work from home, which is happening now, and that all of the office buildings were going to be vacant, and that could maybe be a solution. And this is paraphrased to me, so, you know, do your own research. Like we said before, look for yourself, Snopes it. you know, one of the things he was proposing is all the empty buildings could help solve the homelessness problem and people could move in there. And the problem is, though, is like we were discussing, because everyone is kind of for profit, which I understand this country is built on capitalism, but at the same time, it's like, you look around, you look at all the empty buildings, you're like, there seems like there's a solution here, but it feels reachable, but then not attainable, right? Like, what paradigm would have to happen where people could say, okay, this is vacant, let's just open this up. Like some benefactor or someone, like, let's just open this up to people who need it.
Jeff Bezos has enough money. Like, we can find, the money exists.
Yeah, it's there.
Let me tell you, that money exists. And I think it's us just using our people power to speak up. And we just have to want that. And it's about us wanting, not just for ourselves, but as a community. We have grown so incredibly selfish. Everybody, like, surviving for ourselves. And we need to start looking, because unfortunately, when you're just looking out for you and everyone's just like self-care, yeah. Yes, you got to put your own oxygen mask on first. But community care, when did we stop caring about the community and stop caring about our brother and our sister and our neighbor, you know? And there are, and it's sort of like coming to the table of like, you know, I don't have all the answers. I don't know what a system without a prison looks like, but let's come to the table and discuss. Like you said, like, what do we do with those buildings? How would we be able to pay for it? Like, okay, is there a charter or a bill that we need to pass to be able to get that subsidized? Like, the money and the resources are there. It's just going to take work to do it and a want and desire to make it happen. But I think we have a social responsibility to make it happen.
And I think the last kind of thing, you touched on it with the community piece. And I think that's what we're seeing with COVID, right? Like, I think people have shifted their mindsets from, we have a community responsibility, to an individual kind of want and need. And so when I see people who are anti-maskers or just being irresponsible in how they're, you know, coexisting with other people in shared spaces, it's definitely very frustrating, because you're making other people, if you don't want to wear a mask, that's your prerogative, but then stay at home. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, don't go and expose other people who might be elderly or have, you know, pre-existing conditions. It's just, you know, but again, a lot of people don't have that community piece of it anymore, which sucks.
A lot of white people. You can
you're like, it's a euphemism. I'm like, you know,
some of you, I mean, some of y'all got yoga communities, so you get it, you know, but I do think, like, amongst POC communities, we have grown up with a more of a sense of community. Hence, again, Minority Corner back in high school, we were surviving together and we were bound together. But there has to be a more sense of shared responsibility and collective responsibility and community. The only way it's going to work. So are prisons obsolete? I say yes. Done. They're out. They're gone. All right. On to the next order of prisons.
We interrupt the podcast you're listening to tell you about another podcast. That's right. We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's correct, Mark. This is Hal. We do the hard work for you, settling all of the meaningless arguments you have with your friends.
So tune in every week on the Maximum Fun Network for We Got This with Mark and Hal, and all your questions will be asked and answered.
You're welcome.
All right, that's enough of that.
We got this.
Well, when you just thought that there couldn't be one thing that wasn't problematic, guess again.
What? What else is problematic?
You might think you're innocently having a taco, and little do you know, you need to know how to decolonize your food.
What? Oh my gosh, this is great, because we have had someone come on and we've decolonized our bookshelves. I feel like there should be a show like Move Over Marie Kondo. It's called like Decolonize Your Life. And we just go through all of these different aspects. It's like your fridge. Oh, no, that's colonized too. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
We go through it. Your closet. No way. Your music.
Instead of like holding it and see if it brings you joy, like hold it and like get messages if you need to decolonize or not. You're like,
oh my God,
this feels wrong.
Hold it and see, like, look up its racist history. You're like, oh my God, I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I feel like the first step is realizing the origins of your food. So there's a lot of fake news, kind of myths around foods that we know and love and their origins. So for example, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I want to get some Belgian chocolates, or I want to get English breakfast tea. Well, little did you know. That would be part of it. We'd have like someone hold like a box of chocolates. And I was like, no, because did you know? and I'm holding like a cacao pod. I'm like, this is from, yeah, all over the
oh
world.
Oh my gosh. And, wow.
You know, from Africa, that's where a lot of cacao is sourced. English breakfast tea, believe it or not, is a blend of Indian, Kenyan, and Sri Lankan teas. So none of it is, in fact, English. Just the fact that they took it and rebranded it.
Shut your fucking face. I am throwing a table right now. I am literally a housewife in Atlanta, and I am throwing a table. That's insane. And here's what's really fucked up. I bet you how much of the profits go back to these fucking countries that they are. All right. Wow. All right.
Zero.
Keep it coming.
Another thing I think that's interesting is everyone associates, you know, apple pie with Americana. There's a whole series about it, right?
I mean, there's a song about it. Everything. That goes on for too long. If you play it at karaoke, I will probably express my Second Amendment right. I'm just saying.
Which version? The Madonna? No, I think she's canceled.
Yeah. She says the N-word one time. Like, I was going to say one too many time. Once is too many.
She's canceled. So when you break down all the ingredients, apples are from Asia, ginger's from Southeast Asia, nutmeg is from Indonesia, sugar's from India, and pastry's from France. This one's a little controversial, where pastry is really from, if it's really from France. I saw a few things on the blogs.
Wait, so when someone says, oh, you know, it's actually the sentence does make sense. We're going to reclaim the sentence because someone says it's as American as apple pie. They mean that they've taken things from other places and called it their own. So that works.
You should reclaim it. I love it. You should say it. You're like, yes, it is. And this is why.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That is as American as apple pie because you just have taken it from everybody else. You have raped and pillaged to make something sweet and delicious, and you didn't make it and slap your name on it. You Rachel Dolezal out it.
Yep, absolutely. And this is a tangent, but have you heard that no longer the saying that it's a melting pot is actually racist?
It's a fruit. You were a salad bowl.
It's called a salad.
Because you want,
Yes, you know it too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because with a soup or a melting pot, it means like everything just melts into each other. And it's actually just assimilation. It
becomes homogenous.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what you want is the salad where it's like the tomato is still the tomato. The lettuce is still the lettuce. The like, you know, the raisins for some of you. The croutons is still the croutons, you know, doing its thing. And it. Crunchy, crunchy, and still keeps all of its own flavor and makes this delicious, you know, healthy snack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I like the reclaiming of the apple pie, but don't believe the hype. This Thanksgiving, if you have apple pie, it's not all made in the U.S. of A. That's just not true. None of it. So I think it's important, number one, to pay homage to the heritage of where these things are coming from and just understanding it. Taste the Nation, I wanted to recommend that. I don't know if you watched it. It's on Hulu with Padma Lakshmi. Does an amazing job of going to different communities and learning about their cuisine and really presenting it in a way that it's not really about her. Because at first I was a little skeptical. I was like, is this going to be like a Top Chef-y type experience? But it's not. Like, she really like turns the camera around to different people and you get to learn about their food. So I think it's really cool. Item two, and this is what I want to talk to you about, kind of a bigger discussion. Appreciation versus appropriation. So I've seen the definition of food appropriation as being not giving the country of origin credit. So what are your feelings on this? If, for example, you see a fusion restaurant or you see someone who may not be of a certain ethnicity opening a restaurant that specializes in a different country's cuisine. Like, what are your thoughts about
that? Great question. I'm rarely okay and comfortable with it. I'm just going to say this and y'all just, you know, listen, don't come burning down my house because you know what? That makes you sound like someone at the Tulsa riot trying to kill black people. So don't do that. I'm okay with it if it's like POCs experimenting with other foods. Like if it's like, I don't know if it would be like a black person opening up like a Korean barbecue soul food fusion place. I'm like, oh, that's dope. Like, you know, given I would be less comfortable if it's like literally Rachel Dolezal being like, I'm opening up a soul food restaurant. I'd have issues and I'd have pause. And also it's interesting too, like white people in soul food, especially the folks in the South, it's like they learned all of that food from their slaves, like, or their maids or their black, you know, chefs who ran their houses and ran their lives. So I think it's just really interesting because, you know, white people can get down with some soul food too, and they can do a really great job. But just like know where that came from. I think I'm less like it's I'm less like with food. It's different because it's I feel like it's all I guess like I like the thing that you said. It's when you give credit to where it came from. And I think that is really key because it's different when it's like, you know, Felicia wearing a headdress of at like Coachella or something. Right. And just so you guys know, Felicia's white. Which is even worse, or like that's what she says, but her mama probably named her like I don't know, Allison or something.
I guess
as long as like credit is going, I just keep picturing Paula Deen, you know. God, what are your thoughts? Right, like I think as long as like credit is going, and I feel like I just feel like POCs tend to have more of a respect for other culture, where I don't think like other POCs are like this is mine. Although sometimes some of the Asian kids who like to dance to hip hop like to be like this is mine, and then sometimes they're doing it as like using it as a rebellion. Because, like, their parents, like, think that, like, rap music is bad and they're using it as, like, a rebel. They're using it, like, how white girls will date a black guy to, like, make their parents, like, mad.
You feel like it's more of, like, a shock value versus, like, an appreciation.
Sometimes. Like, it's just, like, always know where it came from and that it's not yours. And understanding that, like, your appreciation versus appropriation, I think. Like, it just, you know the history of something, know where, like the full thing of like, you know, where it came from.
Yeah, this is a hard subject for me because I definitely feel someone is paying homage to something or they're showing appreciation. I can see it done in a appropriate way where I'll give an example. There's like kind of like a, I would say almost like California cuisine, Mediterranean restaurant, like in Oakland and Berkeley, it's a chain. And a lot of people are upset when it first opened up because they were like, oh, okay, well, you're cooking food, you know what I mean, that is not of your origin. But to me, it's like there's almost that it's its own genre in a way. Like they're not trying to call it something that it's not. Like if I went into the restaurant and they were wearing turbans and stuff, like I'd be like, oh, like 86, this place. Like,
yeah, you're totally right. It is like kind of like at its presentation and how they're going about it. You're
and
right.
And I do see, yeah. Like, I haven't personally seen anything problematic there where they're saying like, oh, look, we invented the pita. Like, you know, and then I feel like, oh, yikes.
And then I think it's on us as consumers to not only go to just that restaurant, to also support, because it could also be putting, especially if it's like a white owned business, a white Mediterranean business, and it could be putting out folks who are more connected to that culture, like down the street. And so I think it's on us as consumers then to also make sure that we're consuming both, voting with our dollars and supporting all of the businesses. So it is, because it could just be a thing where it's like white folks are doing the, you know, they're doing the Chinese restaurants, they're doing a lumpia, they're doing some soul food and some Mediterranean, and they're all like white run and owned and doing the little like, you know, California twist, and we're all,
yeah, they're like all organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and that's the thing. You know, I go to a lot of spots that are mom and pop spots and I want to support that. And it's also problematic, I think, sometimes, not only for the people who are the restaurateurs, but like the diners. Like I was at this place in Oakland that I go to. And I was in line one time, there's another person in line, like it had just got quote unquote discovered, like this place has been around like forever, right? But nope. I think it got a write up nope. like in the East Bay Express nope. or something. And so there's a lot more people. And then I hear someone in line say, oh, I feel like I'm in Arabia. And I was like, oh God, problematic. But then, so I think it's on both sides. I think it is on the people who ate the restaurants.
So I'm sorry. I'm still wasn't that on hopeful? That conversation. A total Becky, and we can say that because we went to high school with a Becky who's not really a Becky.
Yeah, she was also a minority.
She was part of the minority corner, but just like, oh my God, I feel like I'm in Arabia. Like that is disgusting.
Definitely. So I think it's on both people, right? Like if you're going to like quote unquote get adventurous and go to a place that you are not gone before and you feel like you're on the special cultural outing, maybe it's not in the best form to say you feel like you're in Arabia. Number one, Aladdin lied to us. Arabia is not a place.
No, it's not. It's just some racist ass sort of like general bullshit, right?
It's just it's like an amalgamation of like all of these countries. Like, it is not a real place, people. Like, Disney lied to you.
You mean I can't go on an Arabian night carpet ride through Arabia?
That's what she probably thought she was on. She's like, oh yeah, like,
ooh, don't you dare close your eyes. Why don't you close your mouth? I think anytime you're going to another culture's thing and it feels like a zoo experience, that's when give yourself pause. If you're like, ooh, this is, anytime it's starting off with, ooh, this is exciting, or I'm kind of scared, you know, ooh, what will happen, or ooh, what, like, that's where you want to stop, because that's your sort of privilege, and you're going on a zoo experience, and other people's culture is not, it's not your zoo. It's not something to be looked at or gawked at. Like, you just be respectful. Yeah. Be a fucking respectful human being.
And it's like, we all here, I don't fault someone for having a new experience or wanting to extend outside of their comfort zone, but I do fault you for saying ignorant shit.
Oh yeah. In fact, your best bet is probably just to keep your mouth
right,
shut
while you're there
to make sure.
Google later.
Just observe. Yeah.
You're like, what's that? You're like, you don't have to like outwardly say, what's that? You could just like,
well, this is different. Google. Oh my God, this is so ethnic. Oh my God. Ooh. Oh, it's too spicy. It's too spicy. Man, there's no peppers on that. There's just salt. Oh
yeah, so you know, I think if someone's not stealing ideas and trying to claim them as their own or profiting off of communities and not giving any kind of monetary, you know, I don't want to say kickback, but just monetary help or like anything like that, like I think it's a problem. But yeah, when it's appropriated and someone's just like you said, Rachel Dolezal's soul food restaurant.
Yeah. You know what, too? If you are a good idea, how about, too, like, if you are doing a restaurant that is not necessarily your community that you are naturally a part of, like maybe are you donating to certain organizations that totally are going to support that, you know, specific community, giving back, right? Like, don't just Iggy Azalea this shit, right? Because, like, again, part of the issue with her was when Black Lives Matter was happening, she's making all this money off of like the sound of Black folks' music, and she's not showing up for the community. So if you are stepping into that, like, no, like if you are paying homage, you're now like, you know, stepping into that community and, you know, do your part and support it and uplift it.
Absolutely. And I agree with
but
you.
But don't take center like, stage. Like don't Michelle Pfeiffer this.
And look, there's fusions on all levels. And what I thought was interesting too, when I was reading about this, I mean, I hate to say it, it's rearing its ugly head, but there are some foods that have come out of colonization, like the bubble tea and like the bun mi.
Right.
Yay or nay? Are we canceling it? Are we keeping it? We need that show. Let me hold it and think.
I'm not.
I'll hold my bun mi.
I'm not a huge, like, I'm not like a huge food fad person. I'm real simple when it comes to food. I'm gonna be real. I'm not a foodie. I eat for the mechanics of it to just keep me going.
Just for sustenance.
Yeah, that's kind of me. That's me. So I'll eat anything, but I'm not waiting in line for nothing. And
no bubble teas, no bun me.
Couldn't care less. But for everybody else. But it's also too, I guess maybe too, I kind of have a thing of like, oh, I don't know if this is like for me. Like, I also have this bit of a pause, like I don't fully understand it, and so I won't go into it until I fully really understand it and what it is. And kind of like, there was like the raw sushi bowls everyone's into. What are those? Poke bowls. Yeah, the poke. So it took me a minute to like dive into that, because I was like, well, what is this? Is this for me? And once I understood it, you know, I'll get it. But you know what? Relatives doesn't sushi.
Yeah, exactly. So there's one company, there are actually a few I want to recommend. Diaspora Co. In her own words, she's a queer woman of color-led business here to put money, equity, and power into the hands of small organic spice farmers that are leading the way in sustainability, regenerative agriculture, and truly delicious spices. So her company is awesome. She's reclaiming the spice trade. So that's another trade that people were profiting off of. And there wasn't a lot like direct kind of like from the farmer to consumer. And so she's helping bridge that gap. And I love, yeah, supporting businesses that also kind of have that mission in mind. And then there's also, and it's kind of timely, you know, the holidays are coming up. There's Menudo chocolates from Ghana. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I think I did. That they source also.
It's Minority Corner. We pronounce nothing correctly. And we
know, I'm like,
oh no. They know. We can't be pronounced. We don't know. They got a hand computer. They can Google it.
I know. Google it. See for yourself.
Know it for yourself, y'all. We can't be doing all the work for you. Hello. It takes a village. Y'all in the Seriously. Corner together too.
Yeah, that was full circle. Community. Google
See?
It.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a big thing, you know. And also, I don't know if you watch Trigger Warning with Killer Mike. Have you watched that show on Netflix?
I've seen a few episodes.
Have you seen the one where he talks about how long a dollar can circulate in different communities?
Oh, like he was trying to keep it in the black community, and there was that Asian stripper, and he was like, "I'm sorry, I need you to get off my crotch," because
he's like, "Sorry,
I'm trying to keep this dollar in the black community." Sorry.
So I'll just repeat it. So Asian people, he said, can keep a dollar in the community for 28 days before releasing it. I think white people is 23, Jewish people 21, and the black community can hold on to their dollar for 6 hours. So thinking about supply chain and thinking about who you're supporting and thinking who you're gifting from is really important. And we have, you, like you said, you vote with your dollars. We have the resources. We have the internet. Instead of supporting Amazon, you could get a gift from one of these local artisans. So just something to think about. Food for thought.
That's really, and it does bring it sort of full circle. Again, like everybody who I'm seeing all these, you know, a lot more, you know, white people get down with the cause, and it's really sort of full circle. And again, I think this connects even to when we're talking about new alternatives from prison structures and reimagining a new society. It is investing into, you know, black restaurants and black businesses. And so we can keep our money also circulating within our own community and uplifting our community as well. And so it goes full circle, creating space for others to be able to shine bright and also to, you know, I think it's everybody's responsibility to own up for the sins of the past. And so, if you're part of a community that benefited from the enslavement or disenfranchisement of other groups and communities, like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it's part of your legacy to turn that beat around and to make sure that we own up to those mistakes and short failures. And it's all connected. It is all connected from the prisons to the decolonization of your food. Like, there is a through line to all of those. So work to be done, and good thing Leah was here to help us go through our fridges and clear it out. English breakfast tea, you cancel. Well, that's our show. Some of the names of high school friends may have been changed to protect themselves. Maybe they weren't, but we'll protect ourselves in that saying that they were renamed. So good to have Leah here on the show. So great. And that's going to do it for us this week. No fact check from last week's episode, because as far as I know, everything we said was perfect. But let us know. Keep us 100. You can tweet at us. You'll let us know. You're never shy about that. We appreciate it. It takes a village. You can tweet at us at Minority Corner, or let us know what's up on Instagram. Definitely be following us on Instagram as we are releasing Minority Corner clips. Yes, you don't have to just listen to our faces. You can see our faces. We are releasing fun little clips, because some of the stuff we do, it's just so, you got to see the faces we're making and the dance moves we're doing, high kicks and all. So you can check that out on Minority Corner. Get on in it. And also you can follow us. We have our Facebook group, the Minority Corner Kids Playground. We'll be releasing some content there, just all over the place. We're going to be wherever you are. Maybe some YouTube stuff coming at you soon. It's going to be good. And oh my God, ugh, what am I doing? I'm like, so had such a great time with Leah. I forgot, y'all. By the time you hear us, the polls will have been closed. So make sure that you have voted. If you can do whatever you can do to make sure that when we are chatting next week, we're going to be feeling good. Aneke is going to be back here. Yes, because we need her to help us process and understand everything that we have gone through. I just thinking about the last time when we had the election 4 years ago, And it was one of our best episodes. We had a really great episode way back then to fire us up and get us into action. And no matter what, there's still got to be work to be done. But will our road be paved more difficult or easier? We'll find out. So make sure to vote. Get everybody to vote. Work. There's so much work to be done. Text banking is easy. You can make it a party. Phone banking, donating, all the things. Just make sure that when we wake up on next Wednesday that we're like, yes, we did everything that we possibly could do. So with that, the episode might come out a little bit. If you are a Friday listener, the episode might come out a little bit later on Friday because we will still be needing to process and record the episode to make sure we're giving you as up-to-date information as we possibly can. But Anahi will be here. And no matter what, the election will be done a week from now. So there is that. Pray. Put your crystals in the moonlight. Do your dances. That's so Raven, what do you see? And there it is. All right, I'm gonna get out of here. I love you all so much. Big thanks to Sam Jackson and Sarah who work on the show. Y'all know what you do. All right, thank you all so much for listening to Minority Corner, because together we're the majority. I love you. Vote, wash your hands. We got this.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.